Dean, do you remember how to do the old historic core opening of the show?
Coming to you live from the historic core of downtown Los Angeles, all in right. the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. This is your Chilpec Hollywood Hour? Something like
that? Exactly, something like that. So I'm going to count you in.
Oh, okay.
3, 2, 1. High energy.
And now, your Chilpec Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
From the heart of the historic core, in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia, this is your Chilpec Hollywood Hour. I'm Dean Haglund with my co-host and newly married
co-host,
Mr. Phil Lairness, ladies and gentlemen.
Why, thank you for remembering, Dean Haglund.
Remembering that you got married.
All of it.
All of it. Oh, yeah, the whole...
Look, I hazard core. A guess that if you did that intro once every 4 or 5 years with, you know.
Perfect it?
You would perfect it, yeah.
Let's keep that hope alive.
Did you watch the Oscars, Dean Haglund?
I did not watch the Oscars. I had to return a faucet to a plumbing store in the Valley, and by the time I got home.
Why are you not having any levels there? Are you not talking into the microphone?
I'm talking, like right there. There's levels. So, yeah, then... then I tried to watch the Philadelphia Experiment. I thought that'd be a good alternative, and that
just in honor of all the Oscar nominations, yes. Michael Paré dreamt that he would receive.
Who?
Michael Paré, the star of the Philadelphia Experiment, and Eddie in Eddie and the Cruisers, and the star of Streets of Fire.
Oh,
Michael Paré, very much alive, though his career. Could be one of our celebrity deaths. Okay, I am not allowed to talk to you about where I saw the Oscars last night.
Because it was at the Egyptian.
No, shh. You're not allowed to. It really, we were told you can't, we were not there. I'm not even joking. We were not there, and there is an entire social media embargo on the Oscar party I did not attend because it did not happen.
Why? Because it's illegal?
You know what I wanted to talk to you about before we get to the Oscars?
Jeez.
Because we will. But this has been on the agenda for a little while. Some horror sequels and remakes that will lead into a conversation I've wanted to have with you about the idea in this day and age, we know we're still living in an age of risk management.
Right.
Always going to be. But apropos of that, to compare and contrast remakes versus reboots versus sequels.
Right.
Okay. I saw Halloween,
right.
which got really good reviews, written by Danny McBride, mm-hmm. David Gordon Green, who did Pineapple Express.
Big deal.
And got great reviews when it came out. And I was really eager to see this thing.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God, Jordan Peele, you remember him?
Yes, of course.
Made Get Out.
Right.
And that's a scary movie that's very funny.
Right. They thought that's
comedy and horror can go very, very well together.
Scream had some funny bits.
How about Psycho? Hitchcock understood that.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so this seems like a perfect match.
Right.
And Danny McBride and David Gordon Green bring no comedy to it whatsoever.
What?
I mean, there are certain inside jokes in that there is something in the film that alludes to each of the previous 11 Halloween movies. Like something specific to each of the 11.
Right, that's pretty good.
Even though the whole premise of the movie is that this is a direct sequel to the first one, and none of the others happened.
Oh.
So this is a long-awaited sequel to the original film from John Carpenter.
Right.
Saying that only that one is canon.
Okay.
And so, none of the others happened.
Right. Halloween 8, Freddy Takes Manhattan, did not happen? He didn't?
Freddy wasn't in the Halloween movie, so I'm glad that that one didn't happen.
That's what it was called.
But Season of the Witch didn't happen. But there's something in the film that does allude to it.
Right.
So those are kind of amusing little jokes if you're aware of all this. But there's no comedy per se.
Right.
And it sorely needs it.
Well, but, you know, Danny McBride, his style of comedy is not joke-laden.
No, indeed. Vice Principals, which you know I liked a lot and was very, very funny, it is also at times super scary.
Right. Dark. It's a dark workplace comedy.
Well, and there is a murder attempt that is horrifying in that show.
I saw that one.
But so I would think of all people, he would understand it's all right to let some humor be in there. And it really could use it.
Right.
But
isn't it funny that he referenced 11 other...
I guess, but that's an intellectual joke, not a visceral joke.
Funny, ha-ha.
Right?
Yeah.
And sometimes when humor is used well, like with Jordan Peele's Get Out, it only deepens the sense of horror.
Right, but he also directed it. Danny McBride didn't direct this one, right? So
but David Gordon Green does do Pineapple Express. His best stuff is comedy. In fact, I would say the lack of any kind of discernible auteur hand really hurts this Halloween.
Oh.
Because Carpenter had that.
Right.
And Carpenter's style had a certain built-in humor to
right?
it.
Right. And even, yes, and he was hands-on on that thing from top to bottom, including writing the music for that thing. So I think if it was Danny McBride, well, dare I say he directed it? If he directed it,
maybe
he would have better staged the jokes or the comedy that he thought he had written in there.
And certainly you would think Jamie Lee Curtis would be game for that.
One would think.
So there's another horror remake that comes out at roughly the same time, does not get the box office success of Halloween, which, by the way, biggest box office opening ever, I think it was, for a film with a female lead over a certain age.
Oh, right.
Whatever age we say that Jamie Lee Curtis is over. it might be even anyone over 50.
Maybe.
So there's another female-driven horror remake that comes out roughly the same time from Luca Guadagnino, and this is the Oscar-nominated filmmaker of most recently Call Me By Your Name.
Ah, right.
And who does these kind of lush quasi-romantic character dramas and explorations, like A Bigger Splash. And he remakes Dario Argento's Suspiria.
Oh, yeah.
And this gets a lot of top 10 love among critics.
Okay.
And very little box office.
Okay. Well, because how many people saw the original Suspiria?
Suspiria, I think, was a big hit at the time, so much so that it launches Dario Argento's a trilogy of the three evil sisters. The second part of the trilogy is Inferno, starring Lee McCloskey, the same Lee McCloskey who talks at our wedding last week about the importance of sitting in the fire after he battles the fire in Malibu. And he points out that, you know, one of the reasons he wanted to protect his home so much is that they have been holding salons there for 29 years.
Right.
And I point out to him, well, what else happened exactly 29 years ago? Inferno came out starring him. So this whole thing, sitting in the fire, has been a big part of Lee's career.
Fantastic.
And indeed, it's while making Inferno with Dario Argento that he starts really incorporating mythology into his artwork.
Wow.
Anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk about with this version of Suspiria.
Oh, okay.
So this Suspiria, really interesting ideas, some wonderful performances, really long, and not... again, very rewarding on an intellectual level.
Right.
Lush to look at.
Not scary.
But not visceral.
Right. Right. Does it resonate deeply enough? And this is what horror movies have to do.
Or, you know, isn't this an interesting way? It might resonate deeply because it calls upon echoes of our collective mythological archetypal inheritance.
Right.
But it doesn't resonate primally.
Ah, right? Because that's the thing.
Doesn't there have to be something of the primal fear in these things?
Yeah, absolutely. But also, has our primal fear changed in the last 10 years, 20 years, because of so many horrors that we face on a daily basis?
And there's some, that's interesting, there's some commentary about that in the movie, because a lot of critics complained that he said it, I think in the 1970s, he said it, or maybe 60s, but he said it in a East Germany, West Germany border area before the fall of the wall.
Right.
And people said, well, you know, it is the 70s, as a matter of fact, because there's an actual terrorist case that's cited in it.
Right.
But, and there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, this seems arbitrary. And he doesn't draw his connection enough to what it was saying about the time. But I got kind of the feeling that maybe what was going on is what you just described, which is, he is talking about how culture changes and modern life changes so much that people forget the horrors upon which all our stories are now based.
Right.
And he was using the Nazis.
Oh, not the Nazis.
That all of this is built upon previous horrors. And with each generation, we get a little removed from the horrors
right.
of it. And we do so dangerously. Yeah,
right.
We get numb to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's fascinating. So then, therefore, exactly, how do you show a movie where you're numb to the horror and still try horrify when you're numb to the horror
That's
that you're trying to
really,
horrify?
Really, really tough, isn't
right?
it?
Right, yes.
And so he has some great ideas that make a remake worthy, and why he wanted to do it.
Right.
And that's one of the first things I'm always looking at, right? I saw the sequel this weekend to the Lego movie.
Oh, yeah.
The official sequel, right? The Lego movie 2, the second part.
Yeah.
Because there's been a Lego Batman movie and
right.
a Ninjago movie, and these are de facto sequels. But this is the official sequel, and we come out of it, you know, and there's some funny bits, and the script was, at least one draft of the script was written by Lord and Miller, who do not direct it. They direct the Spider-Man movie, the Spider-Verse. And maybe they're missed as directors, but we came out of it and Lily was saying, boy, this really needed a rewrite, didn't it? And my gut reaction was, no, this needed a reason to be made in the first place.
Ah.
Like, they could have rewritten it and just gotten more and more clever, which I think, as we've talked about, Deadpool 2, the writers did do.
Yeah.
They worked that script and worked that script and worked that script until it was probably as entertaining and funny as it could be.
Right.
And for the most part, they did overcome the idea that we didn't need this.
Right, right.
And that they maybe had no real reason to make it other than a financial reason. And they came as close to overcoming that hurdle as possible without actually having a reason to make it.
Right.
But Lego 2, you're very aware, there's no innate story. There was something about their connection to childhood and what childhood's like in that first movie, a la Toy Story,
right.
that they really wanted to express and explore.
Right. Now, for my mind, the end of the first Lego movie ended with the terror of a 2-year-old
yes.
controlling
the, something like that, yeah.
right? And I would think that that is the direction you had to follow in Lego 2. And yet, from all the trailers I see, that's not pursued even a little bit.
It's a relationship between that child, now older, and his sister.
Right.
So it's an idea, but it's not an idea that anybody's connected to, and I don't think they even understand the boy child anymore.
Well, see, this...
He services their plot rather yeah. than the plot in the Lego world servicing his emotional needs.
Right. If you ever look at the work of Dave DeVries, a friend of mine who does Monster Engine.
Oh, I do? Yeah.
He works a lot with the children and their monsters and then repainting them in a full three-dimensional way. He was flown out to consult in the early stages of Lego 2 because
oh, really?
They were looking specifically how to connect to that smaller demographic and the thoughts and minds of that child. And so they were finding artists who were working in that oeuvre. And as far as I can tell, they didn't use anything that he talked about.
So we've talked about three movies here. And we can say that, obviously, Lego 2 is a sequel. Mm-hmm. The Suspiria from Luca Guadagnino is a remake.
Right.
And Halloween, as penned by Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, is a sequel because it relates to the plot of the first one and it stars Jamie Lee Curtis.
Right.
It is also a reboot because it now sets the story off in its own direction.
Right, denying...
Without her and with a brand new actor. Not a brand new character playing Mike Myers, but a brand new actor.
Right.
Indeed, the actor hands off because the original actor is in it in a scene, but a new stuntman is required to really inhabit and do the work.
Fantastic.
And brings a real cat-like quality to Mike Myers, which is really interesting. And some of the things they do that's fun is David Gordon Green really allows long, static master shots and lets Mike Myers explore the physical space.
Ah.
So he'll enter and come back and leave. And it's kind of a fun thing. It's like you're peeking through, sometimes you're literally peeking through the window of another home watching what's going on.
That's cool.
It's both that sequel and reboot, a little bit like J.J. Abrams' Trek, right? Where you have Leonard Nimoy playing Spock, so it is a sequel.
Yeah.
And you're rebooting in an entire new universe. All of that gets to happen, but now we're in a new universe.
Right.
So I'm wondering at this point now, for 15 years of remakes and reboots, and because this reboot motif, the modern reboot motif, really seems to start with the Christopher Nolan Batman Begins, the Quantum of Solace, not the Quantum of Solace, the Casino Royale, James Bonds.
Yep.
Because up until then, we would recast the actor, but they were all pretty much sequels until Brosnan.
Yeah.
And then who knows what those were. Those were maiden form commercials.
Maybe.
So you're really, the last two decades is where we have kind of the modern idea of a reboot, and we still have sequels, and we have remakes, and I'm wondering, what's the smartest way to do this? You know, in the Trek universe,
right,
we just mentioned J.J. Abrams.
Right.
You see on TV, well, we're going to reboot with a, or we're going to spin off with a Star Trek Discovery.
Right.
And then we're going to start incorporating
elements
from the original with new actors. So we're kind of rebooting.
Right, but it's jamming it in.
But we're also hedging our bets by creating a Picard sequel series.
Right.
So we're going to do a sequel and a
fallback
and a reboot. While on the big screen, we kind of started doing remakes with a Wrath of Khan remake, right?
Right.
So we're covering all our bases.
So what's the smartest way?
What's the smartest way to do it? I mean, right. Bond, right? We love Casino Royale.
Yeah.
We love the reboot of it, though they missed some opportunities to keep those as sequels because there was always the way, a la Skyfall, when it said that these people never use their real names, except lo and behold, Bond keeps his real name.
James Bond.
And he really is an orphan of the Bond family. Wait, but every other spy? Every other has been using a code name.
Yeah.
Did no one think that as long as they kept that with Bond, then all the previous Bond adventures could have existed too?
Yeah.
That Bond could have been a code name?
Yeah, for all these other... I know.
So up until then, they could have all been sequels.
Different. Yeah.
Ghostbusters, think about this, right? They do a reboot with a female cast.
Right.
And that kind of movie it's kind of dead on arrival because a sizable enough of audience is mad, and maybe they're mad because it's women, and maybe it's a certain misogyny because that thing was being slammed before anyone had seen it.
Yeah.
At which point the original guys say, you know what, we'll do cameos in it to throw our support behind it. But now... They're doing a sequel.
They're doing a sequel.
And it may just be supporting roles.
Right.
But it's in the same universe.
So does that mean they left the Ghostbusters female version out?
Yeah, it's out.
Dry?
It's hung out to dry.
Yeah.
This is a sequel to the original film.
Right.
Decades later.
Okay.
And this seems
problematic.
Does it?
Or does it
seem smart in the way that Creed, the original Creed,
right,
is a sequel to Rocky. Creed 2 is a sequel to Rocky 4. They are also setting up their own potential new universe of exploration for the Creed character,
right,
if we find that new character compelling enough. There is something to appeal to young viewers who don't know Rocky. There's an exciting new young character that speaks to today's, not only moviegoers, but today's cultural climate.
Right.
There is also something for older generations who grew up loving this movie to love about it, which is an exploration of a worthy character later in his life, much like... for people who liked this movie, The Force Awakens.
Right? Yeah. So this comes full circle to the term I've used before. It's used in all the major studios. It's product locomotive. And with any locomotive or any project, any movie that's had sequels can become a product locomotive. And that means you just have to build the right boxcars. Not just movies, but also games, plush, all of that. You build all of that in together, and you don't need the locomotive to be pushing as hard as if you build a second, you know, two-engine product locomotive so that you have the next generation. Like Creed's a perfect example, right? Rocky was a great product. It had a lot of sequels. You built Creed. That can now continue. Those two engines can go, and one can be jettisoned later on, but it's still a product locomotive. You're still thinking about long-term...
Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine.
Right.
Still being within, later on in the timeline, the same universe, and part of that product locomotive.
Right.
And if you needed to jettison something, you could.
You could.
They start to get into trouble when they go to Star Trek Enterprise, which is previous to... It's now a prequel in some ways to the original.
Right.
And now you are in this thankless task of trying to show how all the pieces fit into place.
But J.J. Abrams had laid it out that it's the answer is a black hole.
Well, he doesn't.
No.
By being able to set up an alternate universe,
yeah,
and really reboot things.
Right.
Whereas Star Trek Enterprise, it's in that same universe, and right, everything's leading up to it.
Yes.
Same thing with Discovery.
Yeah.
And we don't know how that's working,
yeah,
out.
Yeah, but you can screw around with time and space pretty easily with some fantastic Einstein.
But the question is whether anybody wants you to.
Well,
and the numbers don't seem to bear out that people want them to.
Well, because you're only looking at single units, you're not looking at the whole locomotive.
The locomotive, right.
The train itself.
That's true.
The entire train.
And part of that is because J.J. Abrams and the movie version still is so separate financially, economically. I think
right,
it's different companies
different
altogether
companies,
are running,
yeah,
it. So there is no locomotive.
Right.
If anything, there might be two locomotives starting to get up to speed that are heading directly at each other.
Right. But in terms of risk management, it doesn't matter if one or two boxcars completely drop the ball on it. You still have enough momentum on the whole.
Which I would say is true of Star Wars, right? Obviously,
right,
they're still coming up with new aspects.
Right.
Online, there's going to be a digital Obi-Wan Kenobi series.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter that people seemed to, I did not, but people seemed to hate The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
And fans really seemed to dislike that movie. And, of course, the Han Solo movie lost so much money. It was the first Star Wars thing, other than the Star Wars Christmas special, to lose so much money.
They
lost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
Did you see the Solo movie?
Yeah, I did.
Did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed elements of it. I liked the Kessel Run. It had elements that you go, oh, okay, this all makes sense. It all held together.
I felt by the end, yes,
right,
they've done it. They've
right,
done it. I felt... You know, with director changes, it's so tough.
So tough.
But it was working so hard. It was doing just enough right, just barely enough right,
yeah,
for most of the movie, But by the end, I went, yes, okay, I doff my cap, and if you do it again, I'm with you.
Right.
But they won't get a chance to do it again.
Right.
And so this kind of gets back to the question. Here is an out-and-out reboot of a character.
Yeah.
And it's the one Star Wars thing that fails. The spin-offs seem to work. Mm-hmm. Long-awaited sequels work. You know, exploring other parts of the universe, which I guess is a spin-off, works.
Yeah.
But this reboot financially did not work.
Well, yes. Yeah. So,
Star
Wars is separate, though, because it's every one of those are so expensive. And I think that one ran into cost overrun. So had they come down in scope and aim all of that sort of thing, the Solo would have been fantastic, as opposed to it being a major linchpin in the 15-1 movie per year plan that LucasArts originally had, right?
Yeah.
So that may be a little more ambitious than, hey, man, let's just build ourselves a giant train, have some, you know, big engines in here, some smaller things, that sort of thing.
So you're telling me there is no right answer, that any of these are smarter than the others, but it is about be realistic about what your budget should be. The female Ghostbusters, it made a lot of money. It lost even more money because it should not have had the budget that it did.
Right.
And we're not reviewing the movie based on its numbers, but we are saying that any artistic merits of it ultimately don't matter in terms of further exploration, because financially no one's going to back it. And they didn't back it because they backed it to too much of a degree to begin with, and probably the stuff that cost so much was not the stuff that was the best in the movie anyway,
right?
Which is all the effect sequences.
Right. So this comes back to risk management. This is where we started.
Or not managing your risk, but honoring what the film needs to be in the first place.
Well, and that's the thing. If I'm just focused on risk management in terms of numbers and not focusing on, aside from does this need to be made, focusing just on the elements of what made this great in the first place.
Star Wars. The original Star Wars is not really this epic film.
No. It's
surprisingly small scope.
Yeah.
And so why is Solo an origin story feel the need to be so epic? Well, because they want to launch something.
Yeah.
We want to launch a product locomotive. But that wasn't the idea with the original Star Wars. The original Star Wars was, I want to tell this story.
Right.
And what's right for this story? So what's right for the modest origin story of this smuggler? I don't know. Tell a really well-crafted, very funny, suspenseful origin story of a smuggler.
Right.
Don't try to make something bigger than Star Wars.
Well, and I think that's originally what was happening, but the directing style of the two
conflicted with the financial needs of the studio.
Because they're improvisational, because they were finding the comedy, because they were going off on tangents, as opposed to Ron Howard coming in and doing the giant set pieces of, you know, getting the Gargonium from the smuggler train and all those things.
You made that word up.
Whatever they were. What was the MacGuffin? I don't know.
But MacGuffin.
A MacGuffin.
Well, get the MacGuffin from the train. We can just say that. You don't have to know. Like,
get the MacGuffin from the train. Yeah, that big set piece sort of stands out, you know, the trailer fodder, as we call it.
Ooh.
Yes. Trailer fodder.
That's my favorite creature in all of Star Wars, the trailer fodder. All right. Hey, I saw one other new movie I wanted to tell you about.
Yes.
Because this is getting a little bit of short shrift. Are you a fan of the Liam Neeson action movies?
I don't think I've actually sat down and watched any of them, tell you the truth.
Give me back my daughter, really, or whatever?
No, I didn't see any Taken. Okay. I saw that one where he beats up a wolf.
I know that one. He beats up a wolf. I know. That really, I found that offensive.
I found it offensive, too. Yeah. It's like, well, come on.
But he's in a movie called Cold Pursuit right now, which is a remake of the Norwegian dark comedy In Order of Disappearance.
Ah.
And Cold Pursuit, is Lily trying to get our attention? What's she doing over there?
She's watching TV.
Oh, okay. In Cold Pursuit is a remake of that from the director. Of In Order of Disappearance,
okay.
Hans Petter Moland.
Oh.
And so this, too, is a dark comedy. It's an action film. Am I going to say it's perfect? No, I am not. But this movie is such a wonderful deconstruction of basically the entire Liam Neeson movie genre.
Oh, really?
And it's really funny.
Wow.
And it's got action. It's got suspense. It's got a huge body count. though it gets funnier and funnier with this. And they even tip their cap to the original by, in the end, when listing the cast, they list the cast in order of disappearance.
Ah, fantastic.
So this movie's getting short shrift, and I must say, for Liam Neeson fans, for action fans, for comedy fans,
this is a thing.
It's a good movie.
Oh.
It's a good movie. I won't say that it's a great movie, but I am saying it could end up on the fringe of a top 10 list next year for me.
Holy crap.
And the supporting performances, again, so many of these movies rely on the villain. I forget the name of the young actor. He was in Murder on the Orient Express, but the young actor who plays the villain, he really makes this movie because, so again, not to say that everybody else isn't doing wonderful work, but you know as well as I do, if the villain isn't interesting,
amazing, yeah,
then the movie does tend to suffer.
Yes.
There's a real, you know, that the gravity of the villain has to hold this thing down.
So true.
And then the hero kind of pirouettes down into that gravity.
Yeah.
Often as the, you know.
As the case may be.
So, it, really funny.
Okay.
I would absolutely recommend that film.
Now, his unfortunate tweet as a marketing disaster.
Was a marketing disaster, and this is one of the things. So, racially insensitive, I guess. Controversy that he's in, and I don't really want to step into this thing.
Right.
I will say that from my point, I think he was trying, it seemed, to make a point that racism is alive and well in all of us, and that he wasn't proud of it.
Right.
And he was basically trying to say, look, I'm looked at as this good guy, and I have had this in my heart.
Right. So,
and I'm lucky that I didn't act on it.
And it's conflict. And it's a thing he's dealing with.
And or did deal with.
Right.
And now it's, how dare you. So I'm not saying that he brought it up right. I'm not saying that there isn't reason for people to be upset. But I do.
And, you know, those discussions shouldn't be had on Twitter. That's what I'm upset about.
I think it was in an interview and it got excerpted. And it's, you know what it is, Dean? It's not about having the conversation on Twitter. It's about journalistic clickbait and about content aggregators. How many times do you click on a story where you go, this is an interesting story, and then you go to the website that's advertising the story, and then when you click on that story, you're now in a whole different
Site of the thing.
Because it was a content aggregator, which is how you found out about it, and then you went through a portal to finally get to the journalistic source
and
of it.
And driven into watching ads and all sorts of stuff.
Or so many articles are written about, around excerpts from other articles.
Well,
so my article is, Dean Haglund wrote an article about, and here's the key quotes. And then if you click on those quotes, I can go to your direct article.
Right, and those are...
Though it might be behind a subscription paywall, so I'm only going to read the
Well, and some of that is even bots now, right? That's just automated bots going around searching out news stories and all of that.
But so the content aggregators, the clickbait, this is really problematic for conversation because you're going to try to drive it with the most, like, you won't believe what the Brady Bunch kids look like
right,
now.
Right. Moses just got 10 commandments. Number 8 will make your jaw drop.
Oh, my God. That's so funny. All right. So I'm not allowed to tell you about the secret Oscars party. But, you know, the show was hostless.
Right.
And as a result, it went faster.
Yeah.
I didn't mind it when it was working.
Uh-huh. When didn't it work?
You know, it wasn't only that there wasn't a host. There were also fewer montages than ever.
Oh, good.
Which can be good. One montage that was there, I don't think they announced it as this, but it basically had the feel of being the montage of all the movies that were snubbed this year. Like, all the highlights are from 8th grade, from the Mr. Rogers documentary, from the Laurel and Hardy film. Like, it's movies that did not get nominated.
And we're sorry. Sorry you didn't.
Kind of.
Wow.
Yeah, kind of the, if you thought that the Spirit Awards, which came out the day before, honored better films, yeah, you might be right. Oops.
It's a different award show.
So that was odd. But the show itself also kind of lacked grandeur and ceremony. It lacked ceremony. And that's the thing is that what's a host? Well, the host is the master of ceremony.
Right.
So let's put the emphasis on the ceremony. How can we keep that? When they did, like with Queen opening the show, pretty great. Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper coming on stage to do the duet of their song Shallow, which won, without an introduction.
Oh, yeah.
And we're behind the stage looking out, and the set is going out, and it looks like one of those moments when we return to the Academy, like, you know, we're changing the set, and when we come back, you know, Cameron Manheim and Cameron Diaz, A Tale of Two Camerons, presenting the award for Best Makeup in Costume Design.
Right.
Right? Like, that's the thing. But instead, the stage is going out, and they just suddenly take the stage. And we're behind them looking out at the audience as they just start to sing. And it was so powerful and so effective. That stole the show. Lady Gaga doesn't really need help to steal the show. But so there were moments like that, but there weren't enough of them.
Right.
And I think that's the thing. You lose the master of ceremony, don't lose the ceremony.
Huh. So that's a director issue. I mean,
so
he had a direction for the song in terms of camera angles and how to build that emotional moment that blew everybody away.
Well, you just probably hit a point. So, because I was wondering this, the banter, we always make fun, you know, the banter is often bad between presenters, but sometimes that's because they don't rehearse, they don't.
Right.
But it was just as written, I was like, is there even a joke? Like, did anybody write anything?
Bruce Valanche, not on point?
You know? It wasn't even poorly written. I mean, it was just like, what? This
what?
Is placeholder.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminded me of the Writers Guild strike year. But isn't it true that often the Oscar hosts are the people that bring on their own writing team?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. It's a big, because so much pressure to deliver.
So here's another thing. If you don't have a host corralling the writing talent, you may also be lacking a certain written vision. Never mind the director lacking vision,
right?
But there's no written vision to direct then.
Right. Yes, nobody has a script.
Whereas there's nothing written as an intro for Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, and the director says, great, let's go with that.
Let's go with
that. I can interpret the nothing that's written.
Right.
That's fantastic. So that gave a certain amount of ceremony. But it was all this other stuff was almost like, well, this is the part where we usually do this, but no one's here to do this for us. So let's make Daniel Craig seem really awkward and the lack of charming.
Oh, no.
And it was really sad.
No.
You know, there's Daniel Craig and Charlize Theron looking beautiful next to each other. Oh, I want to believe they're charming. Oh, yeah, this is why we have writers.
Right.
Yeah.
They're not charming.
So that was the bad.
Okay, that's the bad.
The highlights were Ruth Carter accepting an Oscar after her third nomination for costume design.
Right.
She won for Black Panther.
Oh, yes.
Got her start with Spike Lee, so that was very cool that he was there to witness it. Her speech was everything you want from an Oscar speech.
Ah.
It was inspiring and heartfelt and just full of joy. And an expression of why people make movies in the first place, why they love to make movies. Spike Lee's very political acceptance speech was nevertheless a real highlight and also filled with so much joy. I mean, he ran up and threw himself up into the arms of Samuel L. Jackson, who got to present him the screenplay award. And it was another terrific speech. It made a lot of people angry. But the thing that I now have come to realize about when Spike Lee, whatever he says, Spike Lee moves conversation forward.
Well, that's true, right?
He really does.
Yeah, yeah. So,
And it was advised that maybe the Oscars have found their new Jack Nicholson, that Spike Lee should be in the front row to be bouncing off of
everybody's things.
Had what the journalists are calling a very sore loser moment in reaction to Green Book winning Best Picture. And he said it was not about being a sore loser. He said, I am exactly the same way at Madison Square Garden watching my beloved Knicks. It's simply that the ref made a really bad call. I'm not a sore loser. It's that movie didn't deserve to win.
Ouch.
Although he did point out that, you know, he was snubbed for, he didn't even get a Best Picture nomination for Do the Right Thing all those years ago. He said, if there's ever a movie where somebody's driving somebody, I'm shit out of luck. That's what he said. But at least they switched positions this year, which was nice.
Yeah.
But you know, Spike Lee is a student of cinema. He's not just a firebrand. He's a student of cinema and someone who believes really importantly in the role of a director moving the art form forward
right.
in some ways. And at his best, that's what he has done.
Yes.
So you would want him to root for movies that do just that. He wouldn't be Spike Lee if he didn't.
Right.
And so he looks at a movie like Green Book, I have no doubt, and he sees a movie that gets a lot of votes because isn't it like the movies Hollywood used to make?
Right. Yeah, yeah. Not moving the story forward.
I don't think Spike Lee would have had a problem with Roma winning Best Picture. I don't think with some of the other movies.
Yeah.
Something that pushed envelopes in some way,
right.
stylistically, artistically, thematically, whatever.
Green Book did not do that.
No, it's a pretty conservative movie in terms of storytelling, you know,
right,
in the
yeah.
way it tells its story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I got this one wrong, Best Picture, because I ultimately went with Roma. But
yeah.
you know, I even said on our show that I had been thinking Green Book, but I overthought it, and I thought the backlash against it was going to be enough to keep it from winning Best Picture. But you know what I forgot? Octavia Spencer was one of the producers of this.
Right.
And in her own way, she's as big a deal as Oprah.
Right.
And if Octavia Spencer at this point puts her
stamp
of approval, that goes a long way.
Ah.
And so it was a big reward for Octavia Spencer as a producer. And again, the other answer is when Lily Holloman hits you with one of these things, like
this movie's going to win an Oscar.
In 2004, Donald Trump's going to become president. what? The guy, the art of the deal guy?
Yeah, the deal. How's that possible?
She knows some things. She doesn't say these things often.
Right.
Or lightly, sadly. she's not joking, unfortunately.
Right.
So she was right. And but I only just learned how the balloting works for Best Picture.
What do you mean? Doesn't everybody just get one vote and you vote and that's it?
No.
What?
No. So they're preferential ballots, but not like a top 10 list, right? When they when they do critics' consensus
yeah.
and people submit top 10 lists,
right?
You figure, now it probably varies from aggregator to aggregator, but you assign a certain amount of points based on where that film ends up on your list.
Right.
Right? Like
so
maybe number one gets 5 points and number two gets 3 points and everything below it gets 1 point.
Yeah.
That's one way. Or you go number one gets 10 points and number one gets one or number 10 gets 1 point, right?
Yeah.
And you count down there. So when the Academy, because of Dark Knight getting snubbed, went back to the pre-1944 rules of having up to 10 nominations for Best Picture.
Okay.
1944 until, when was Dark Knight, 2008?
Yeah.
1944 to 2008, let's say, it was 5 nominations for Best Picture every year. So then they go back to the pre-44 rule, which was you can have up to 10. They also went back to the voting system.
Oh. Well.
Which is a preferential voting system.
For someone who's smarter or has been...
So, Dean, I hand you all the ballots. You're
right.
Price Waterhouse. I hand you all the ballots.
Yes.
And everyone has been asked not to vote for Best Picture like you do in every other category.
Right.
Tell me who your best actor is from these nominees.
Yeah.
Tell me who your best director is from these nominees. No. Rank the movies in this year 1 through 8. Rank
them.
All right. And then you get these ballots, Dean... And you separate them out into piles by first place votes. So all the people who voted Roma first place, put them in a
big pile.
Yeah. All the ones who put Green Book in first place, put them here,
yeah.
Et cetera, down the row. The film that gets the fewest first place votes is out.
Okay.
And those ballots... We go to their second place choice, and those second place choices now become their first place votes.
Ooh.
So let's say the film that got eliminated was, I'm not saying that this is true, but
right.
let's say it was Bohemian Rhapsody.
Okay.
Well, after Bohemian Rhapsody, I voted Star is Born number 2. That now becomes a first place for A Star is Born and goes to that pile.
Holy
and
shit.
And And so then we move all the eliminated films ballots into other piles, and now the pile that's the smallest is eliminated, and we assign those ballots, and on
wow.
until we have a winner. So from 1944 to 2008, roughly, the film that got the most first place votes won.
Right.
Like a normal election.
Yes.
Now, the film that is disliked the least
right.
wins Best Picture.
Well, and that explains Green Book altogether, because that would be number two
on a lot of people's list. It would be no one's last place.
Right. And no one's first either.
Well, it might be some.
Might be.
Might be certainly the cast.
Yes, okay.
The producers. Yes. They have a lot of producers.
Yes, okay.
So there would be some. You figure there's always going to be some behind every one of these categories.
Okay.
Because after all, they got enough votes to be nominated.
But isn't there only 5,400 Academy members?
Whatever it is. Yeah, you're right.
So it's smaller.
So I did some digging. And from what I've found, and of course, they never publish this official stuff, but I have this on very good authority.
Okay, like it?
That we know that one film that would have won Best Picture under previous rules did not win because of this, and the Academy is glad, because the Academy doesn't want a polarizing pick for Best Picture.
And
that was The Tree of Life. It got the most first place votes. It also got the most last place votes.
Oh my gosh.
And so it, because of preferential balloting, it never stood a chance on second and third and fourth balloting.
Interesting.
Counts.
And that's the Brad Pitt thing that was sort of the tone.
Terrence Malick.
Terrence Malick directed Brad Pitt in terms of there's no real...
linear story.
Yeah, there's no linear story.
Yeah.
So
isn't that
fascinating?
So that explains Best Picture. Is there anything else that I wanted to talk about with some of these? This is interesting, actually.
Okay.
Documentary I got wrong, because I thought it would be RBG. I may have mentioned on the show that Free Solo, the mountain climbing one, was the one that was getting a lot of
attention.
Jimmy Chin is one of the directors and cinematographers of it, and he did a great film that won, I think, a Spirit Award nomination for in documentary a couple years ago called Maru, about the climbing of that.
Yeah, right.
And his work was astounding. So I have no problem believing that Free Solo is worthy of this. I just thought the Academy couldn't resist the political import of embracing Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right.
So I was wrong.
Right.
And they may have gone for the better movie.
It looked amazing, too.
Which is fine. Yeah.
Because don't you have to see the documentaries on the big screen? Isn't that one of the rules?
No. You don't. Now, sound. The sound categories both went to Bohemian Rhapsody.
Right.
And a lot of people, apparently, on their pools got this right. I got this wrong. And when I was explaining to my friend Christopher Hansen beforehand, during a cocktail hour in reception, during the arrivals at an event I wasn't at,
right?
I explained to him why I voted for A Star Is Born instead. Because Bohemian Rhapsody, so much of the musicals always do great in the sound categories.
Yeah,
even
for sure.
Animated musicals, right?
Right. Frozen.
But I said, because Bohemian Rhapsody, it's the actual recordings, historic recordings.
Oh.
From Queen.
Oh.
Rami Malek doesn't do his own playing and singing. It's Freddie Mercury. It's the original recordings.
Oh.
And the Live Aid recording. It's the actual Live Aid performance.
So
I thought, well, it'll be A Star Is Born because they're performing live.
Right.
They're recording this. They're mixing this live. This is outstanding work.
For sound mixers.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
So he goes, oh, wow, you're right. That is far more deserving. And then there's a moment's pause, and I said, do you think Academy members know that? And he goes, not at all.
Even a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So Bohemian Rhapsody became a
safe. Because it
says,
wow, that sounds exactly like Queen. Because it was exactly Queen.
Previous collaborators of mine did very well. Matthew Bilibatique nominated. John Ottman wins an Oscar for Best Editor.
Mm-hmm.
Christine Waltz, who does makeup for a little movie called The Lady Killers, gets thanked as one of the makeup artists for the Oscar-winning makeup film this time around.
Wow.
So, I'm rubbing elbows with greatness, my friend.
There you are. Just within one step away.
But two awards that I got right that I'm both happy and sad about. I'll start with the sad. Rami Malek wins for Best Actor. I got that right. I knew that was going to happen. It's one of the shittiest performances I've ever seen. It's maybe Roberto Benigni, notwithstanding, the worst performance ever by an actor to win Best Actor. And it's just a terrible, terrible movie. And the whole movie, you're sitting there going, I could believe these guys are Queen, and I can believe that's Rami Malek. almost. He's almost Rami Malek.
Oh, my gosh.
That.
Okay. So, it's just, but he was winning BAFTAs and Golden Globes.
Yeah,
and,
it was he gave great speeches. He politicked really well.
Right.
And that's everything. It's a political campaign.
Damn it.
But Olivia Colman wins for The Favorite.
Yeah, you did not pick that.
I did pick that.
You did pick
that. Yes, I did pick that.
How did you do that over Glenn Close?
Because I can only predict that one actor is going to win for a terrible movie. And the thing was, unlike me, the Academy acknowledged that The Wife was a terrible movie by not giving it any other nominations.
Right.
Even the people I know who love her in that talk about how bad that movie is. So at some point, can we honor a bad movie for this? And you said it yourself, the Academy loves to spread these awards around.
Right.
And I looked at The Favorite and I said, it's not going to win any of these categories.
Yeah.
It's going to lose out to Marvel in some of these tech categories.
Yeah.
What can they give it to? Well, if you're not going to give it to the woman who's the lead in the whole film,
right,
around which it revolves, what are you going to give it? So that's why I ended up saying they'll give it to her.
Huh. That's a good call.
And she was delightful. Plus, doesn't the Academy also like rewarding people who have had, yes, they like awarding the new star like Rami Malek.
Yeah.
But they also love the actor who's been, for lack of a better word, journeyman.
Yes, working the trenches.
Yeah.
Done the comedy.
And that this is their time.
Right.
It's not going to happen again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
make it happen.
So I was really happy about that. And that was a joy. But the most important thing of the show, of course, were the snubs. And when I say the snubs, I mean the snubs in the In Memoriam.
Again, how do they always get this wrong? I mean, how do they get it wrong?
I would like to address a couple of the snubs.
Sure.
Stanley Donen.
Well, but he just died the week of.
The day of it was announced. And I agree with you on that. Everyone is saying, oh, come on, they're filmmakers. They could cut him in. But I think it's more about the timing of the music. It's Gustavo Dudamel and the LA Phil have timed their musical performance to this. How? If you're altering the timeline of the edited piece, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's the day of.
Yeah.
But here's another reason you have a host. Because if there was a true master of ceremonies, maybe not a Jimmy Kimmel, but maybe someone, certainly when we were coming of age, a Johnny Carson, a Bob Hope, someone like that, a Phil Lernis, for crying out loud, would have come out and just mentioned that we give these, as we give out these awards for Best Original Song and Best Original Score, we remember one of the greatest ever to work in movie musicals, Stanley Donen.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, here are, and then, you know.
Just show some clips.
Or you just introduce the presenters, and maybe they get played on to a little bit of Singing in the Rain or something.
Yeah.
That could be done impromptu, in the moment, because a host can do that.
Yes.
Get rid of the stupid joke, whatever the joke was,
right,
to introduce them. But you can't do that when you don't have a host to feed that to.
Right.
So they'll honor him next year, I'm sure. And we, on this show, will honor him next week. How about that?
Let's do that.
We did honor Dick Miller, character actor who was in more than 100 movies. He was not in the In Memoriam.
Right.
We've honored Arlie Ermey from Apocalypse Now, one of the stars of Full Metal Jacket,
the movie
that got me into film school, and Mississippi Burning. He was not remembered in the In Memoriam.
That's odd.
I think we remembered Vern Troyer, Mini-Me.
Mini-Me, we did.
He was not in the In Memoriam. I don't know if that's really a snub.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't know. He's the one on Twitter most people were upset about, but, you know. But I would say the genuine snubs are Sandra Locke, who we remembered and talked about a lot. She's an Academy Award nominated actress.
Right.
And a filmmaker. And in the era of Me Too and Time's Up, when she risked her very career to try to break up the boys' club that was the studio system at that point, and held them to some account in the wake of her her relationship with Clint Eastwood and being denied a career because of breaking up with him.
Yeah.
You remember her, but I'm sure that it's because they didn't want to piss off Clint Eastwood.
Really? You think there's still that much animosity?
There has to be, doesn't there?
I guess, but oh my God.
How do you forget her? She's an Academy Award nominee. I mean, I've asked you this before. How do you not just, when you're starting the In Memoriam, go through cross-referencing who's gotten nominated before?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
If you've been nominated or win, you should pretty well be in there.
Right. That's a good point.
I'm not saying don't include publicists. I'm just saying take care of your own first. Mm. And Carol Channing.
Now that, to me, is the biggest shock.
Yeah, and where I was, and I'm not allowed to tell you where I was, but where I was, that I felt should have been the tiebreaker on the pool. If you guessed that Carol Channing was going to be a snub.
Oh, my God.
And did you hear when her publicist was outraged and texted members of the Academy?
No.
To say, how could this happen? And the response was a uniform, well, we can't include everybody, and she really didn't work in film. Wait. And you know, nobody in Hollywood really knows who she is. That's supposed to make the publicist feel better.
What?
Yeah,
I did not hear that. That is ridiculous.
So
okay,
so those were the snubs. Now, don't snub anyone.
No,
when it comes to celebrity deaths. And we're coming to celebrity deaths right now at the end of our show, Dean.
Celebrity deaths,
here we go.
Do you remember David Horowitz?
David Horowitz. He's a writer.
No, he was 81. He was a consumer reporter. Very big in Southern California before you ever moved here. But he had a show called Fight Back.
No. Okay. Never saw this.
So from 76 to 92, he did a TV show called Fight Back with David Horowitz, where he kept viewers informed of potential product defects and ripoffs.
Hey.
He was a real consumer advocate.
I like this guy.
He tested commercial claims on air on the show. He would replicate the commercials and
try to do them and say they were lies, all lies.
And he would engage viewers with humor, even as he was showcasing company's bad customer service, which pissed him off so much.
Yeah.
And thank God he never had to stay at the Kimpton Everly. The Kimpton Everly.
Kimpton Everly.
We put the no in service. And faulty products.
Right.
Now, he got kind of his greatest notoriety because in 1987, and you may remember this.
Okay.
He was live on air here in Los Angeles on KNBC doing his local news station spot because he did some things on the news. When a man came in, pointed a gun at him, and demanded he read a statement to viewers. Read this or I'll shoot you.
Ooh.
Horowitz calmly took the man's statement, which was a confusing diatribe about the CIA and aliens.
Fantastic.
And read it at gunpoint. Unbeknownst to him or the gunman, the station went off air as soon as the incident began. Oh. And the viewers never even knew what had happened. So Horowitz read it. Did it calmly, asked the man afterwards if he was satisfied and if he felt that he had respected his wishes. And at that point, the gunman admitted that the gun was nothing but a BB gun and an unloaded one at that.
Wow.
The incident prompted Horowitz to pursue a successful campaign to ban realistic-looking toy guns in all of California.
Ah, look at that.
Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. That's a good story.
So
David Horowitz.
David Horowitz, Fight Back, 81 years of age.
Okay, I'm going to look for that.
Can you tell me about Brody Stevens?
Brody Stevens, a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
Really funny. You saw him in The Hangover. I saw him do a couple sets over the years at the Improv and stuff like that.
I never did.
You never did? They were... you know, edgy for sure. And he battle? I'm getting some of my comics confused, but he did have addiction problems that he often talked about on stage. And, you know, he was a front runner for the very confessional stand-ups wave that came after, you know, joke meisters. So.
Highly energetic, I heard.
Yes.
He was often hired to open for television shows. right, to warm up audiences.
Yeah, he did a lot of crowd warm up stuff because he really got everybody into it.
Okay, 48 years old. I had not heard of this man, and the cause of death is under investigation.
Yes.
Which came, here's a celebrity death that came in just under the wire last week. I referenced it without mentioning the man's name. Carmen Argenziano, character actor best known for his role as Jacob Carter in Stargate SG-1.
Yes. So.
Also a regular fixture in recurring roles on shows like Melrose Place, L.A. Law, CSI. And on the big screen, notable but small roles in films like Godfather Part II. And I remember him in Broken Arrow, John Woo's first film in this country.
Oh, fantastic. But
he was kind of that guy who had bona fide gravitas and like kind of tough guy.
Tough guy, yeah. Thing. He was a tough,
tough guy military. While still seeming kind of smart.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Your go-to character actor.
Okay, so Carmen Agranziano, 75 years of age.
Right.
Now, finally, this one is kind of fun.
Fun.
The name Lyndon LaRouche, does that mean anything to you, Dean?
No, it's not.
See, this should have been in part of your citizenship test, I
what?
Think. Lyndon LaRouche, died at 96 years of age.
Okay.
He was a perennial presidential candidate.
Really?
He was a political activist. Big career. I mean, his life is fascinating. I mean, tell me that this doesn't seem like the conspiracy theorist movie of all time.
I'm loving this.
But he was one of the most unusual characters in American politics. Okay, so obviously outside the mainstream. He embraced ideas both from the extreme left and the extreme right.
Oh, cool.
Starting to seem like the modern kind of world in which conspiracy tends to traffic.
Yes.
Right? He, with the support of his small but very intense loyal followers, he ran for president 8 times between 1976 and 2004, including once while serving time in prison.
That's a tough one.
He was born in 1922 in Rochester, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. He was a studious child, became intensely interested in philosophy, reading the great thinkers extensively throughout his teen years, very much like our current president.
Yes.
Brought up as a Quaker.
Oh.
What's your relationship to Quakers?
I love their oats.
No, but your mom was a Mennonite?
My mom's a Mennonite, yes.
Is there any similarity?
Not really, other than their sects of religion that are unto their own communities,
okay.
Sort of. Right. But that's about where it ends.
What about Amish? Where do the Amish fit in?
Amish are, they don't like electricity. So where do they all fit in? Well, they all pursue peaceful paths, but they all follow... an Anabaptist religious following.
Oh, they are pacifists, right?
They're all pacifists, yeah.
Shakers? Okay, we'll get to
Shakers
that next week.
Shakers and Quakers.
Right. So he was brought up as a Quaker. Yes, conscientious objector during World War II. He joins the Army in 1944, serving in a non-combat role with medical units in India and Myanmar, where other soldiers introduce him to the ideas of Karl Marx and Leon Trotsky.
Look at that.
So upon returning to the United States, he joins the Socialist Workers' Party. By the late 60s, he has organized his supporters into the National Caucus of Labor Committees. They would clash, sometimes violently, with other labor-related political groups on the left, and this attracted him the attention of the FBI.
Fantastic.
Extremely paranoid, he created an intelligence-gathering network with sources in the government and military to provide him with daily briefings.
Ooh.
Like a movie about this guy.
Yeah, I want to hear this guy.
Okay. His organization also published propaganda to promote his views on politics and economics.
Okay.
Critics said his caucus was structured more as a cult of personality than any kind of political organization.
Hmm. Again, I always said that. Yeah.
But isn't that true again?
Where we are?
Where we are. His views on politics were shaped more by the teachings of the Greek philosopher Plato and his belief in absolute truth than on adhering to the standard conservative-liberal divide in American politics.
Oh.
All right.
Right.
That's, again, kind of where we're at,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure.
But it's the danger is, again, the cult of personality, right?
Right.
He supported Reagan's space-based defense initiative dubbed Star Wars,
yes.
But was highly critical of his deregulation of the financial sector.
And rightly so.
He supported reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act, which seeks to separate investment and commercial banking activities.
Please.
He and his supporters pushed for a bill in California to quarantine all people diagnosed with AIDS during the 1980s.
Yeah.
Decades later, they denounced the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, for failing to do enough to establish a government-run single-payer healthcare model.
Yes.
Critics also charged that his messages at times were racist and anti-Semitic. Get this. And that his group had ties at various times to both the Ku Klux Klan and the Nation of Islam.
Wow. That's a range.
In 1988, LaRouche was convicted of conspiracy to commit mail fraud involving the default on millions of dollars worth of loans. He was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. Incarceration did not keep him from running for president.
Okay.
In 1988, while serving time, he received over 25,000 votes. He was paroled in 1994.
Fantastic.
Continued to run for president throughout the 90s and early 2000s, usually for the Democratic nomination, despite official opposition from the party itself. What else do I have?
That's great. And so that was the last time he ran?
Or he, yeah, it was 2004. He gained a lot of press attention overseas for his claims that he had foreseen the financial collapse of the late 2000s. These were the latest in a long line of gloom and doom prophecies he had made throughout his career.
I bet.
He also made many claims that he was the target of assassination plots by various world governments and opposing groups. Okay, this
there
is...
This
is the best part. Ooh, I haven't even gotten to the good part yet.
What's the best part?
Outside of politics... This like you should play this guy. He was a fan of classical music.
Okay.
And led an effort to change the concert pitch on A above middle C from 440 hertz to 432 hertz, as the Italian opera composer Giuseppe Verdi had advocated in the 19th century.
Wow.
He also was a vocal critic, an opponent of popular music, rock and roll in particular, and wrote that the Beatles not only, this is a quote, lack genuine musical talent.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did the Beatles lack genuine musical talent, but also, quote, were a product shaped according to British Psychological Warfare Division specifications.
Spectacular.
Lyndon LaRouche, dead at 96. You...
I should follow
or
this.
Or write a play about this guy or something. Yeah.
Yeah,
this is the role you were born to play.
Oh, my God.
A over C.
A over C at 432 megahertz.
Yeah.
That's the name of the play right there.
You know what it made me think of? You know what else is also supposedly a product of British Psychological Warfare Division specifications?
What's that?
This podcast.
Ah.
And you can find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. You can download them. You can stream them. You can subscribe via iTunes.
Even write a review about the specifications.
Please do. Yes. What could be more fun? Tell us if we're at the right hertz or not.
Exactly. It hurts. We give till it hurts.
Yeah. And and sometimes it hurts so good. All right. Can people write us?
Yes. You write us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram.
I think the general manager of the Lost Spirits Distillery did. I'm so excited about
this.
We're so excited.
Follow that up.
I'm so glad that they're going to be back online in May. This place. Oh. Oh, boy, I can't wait.
Yeah, okay. We'll talk about more of that.
We'll talk about that in the future.
Instagram and Twitter, we're at Dean and Phil.
Spell out the word and.
And on Facebook, where are we there?
Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. Please like us.
Yes, but do whatever you do on Facebook these days.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know.
I don't know. Ignore things. If you're not too busy ignoring things on Facebook, please like us.
Please like us. That's not so hard.
All right.
Till next week, I'm Dean Haglund.
Now, are we doing another show in L.A., or are we going to just wait until you're back to the Motor City and record
Let's wait till Motor City, I guess.
Okay.
Well,
because you leave on Saturday?
I think so, yeah. Sunday.
I mean, this is kind of what they used to say, ad lib till ending, right? Like we're fading down.
Yes, the music.
And the music is coming up. Like the old days.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.